So, this is the... Yeah, we ready?
Yes.
This is the fourth and final session for the series and for the year. But before we begin, just a couple of announcements. So I mentioned this last week, we have two Hanukkah sessions coming up at people's homes. Yaakov. Look. What we do without Yaakov? No? That doesn't work. Maybe it's not on, I don't know. Oh, sorry. Oh,
okay.
Thank you so much. Okay, so back to where we were. So there's two Hanukkah sessions in people's homes. The first one in Ariella Sweetie's home. It's Monday, 19th September in the morning, 10 a.m. for women. And then there's also the Wednesday. I'll send out broadcast and reminders and stuff. Wednesday, 21st of December, which is also the middle of Hanukkah at the home of Adam and Lisa Zions. That's 7:45. I think it's 9 Carter Street or something in Rand Week. All right, so. Also, I didn't put on the thing, but we also have the summer learning program, which we do every year, which will be for 4 days this year, Monday the 26th till the 29th, 26th, 27th, 28th, and 29th of December. So first of all, just a little review of last week. We talked about calmness, the matun, metinut, the idea of metinut, which we said was the idea of waiting. We had the concept of that it's like it's something you need to let gel, right? So one of the commentaries says that metinut in Aramaic comes from an expression of a liquid which has to gel still, has to set. So it comes from being present, it comes from the idea of waiting, reflecting to make a resolution, pause before responding, and so on and so forth. It comes from being present, from learning to notice. More details, more depth, different angles of the story, being mindful, and so on. We discussed the difference between metinut and zrizut. That's not a contradiction. In other words, whatever we do, we should be fully calm and present, but not procrastinate when it finishes. In other words, when we finish one thing, we get onto the next thing, but calmly and with presence. And we talked also a little bit about how that happens. To be fully present often comes together with the concept of faith. And we discussed at length the story of Joseph, how he was so present and each day he took as another mission from God and another value, opportunity, and so on, which came from a lot of faith, hashgacha pratit, and so on. He talks about some practical things, breathing, being healthy, eating healthy, exercise, all that contributes to the ability of being more present, being calmer, and waiting, and taking things in a measured way. Okay. Today, we're going to take a very interesting chapter in the book that we were working through. I called it self-control, but it's actually not exactly what the translation of that chapter is. It's a chapter which it calls the Gate of Azivat HaTa'ava, which means to leave behind Ta'ava. Now, I'm going to use the word Ta'ava a lot because Ta'ava is a hard word to translate. It can mean different things. But essentially it's about not giving in to indulgence, to a temptation. It's the tava means to desire, right? To want, but to want strongly. Sometimes tava's use the word lust even. Impulses, lack of boundaries, temptation and things like that. So he has a chapter about how one has to learn to control their tava. One has to learn how to control their impulses and forsake or leave behind or limit some of those areas of ta'ava that we have. Okay, now what does that mean? So let's take this a little slowly and we'll go one step at a time. So let me begin with the first quote that he has in that chapter about ta'ava. He says the following. He says, the sage observed, right, because he always starts, Amar HaChacham. He says, the experiences of man will not be complete until these worldly pleasures and strong desires depart from his soul. Now, we'll talk about pleasure in a minute because obviously pleasure has a room and even in Jewish thinking, right? But there are two points that come out of this paragraph which is important to understand and why he says this. Why does he say that the experience of the person will only be complete when he forsakes his worldly pleasures? So first of all, there's an interesting piece from Nachmanides. Nachmanides was like a 12th century sage. On the famous paragraph in the Torah, there's one of the parashiyot, one of the weekly portions of the Torah, is called Kedoshim, holiness, right? And it's there the Torah gives a command, Kedoshim Tihiyu, you shall be holy. That's the command, right? So the Ramban, Nachmanides, asks the question, and he's famous Ramban, and he says, what kind of command is it to be holy? Aren't we... I understand the Torah has lots of mitzvot, so he's supposed to light Shabbos candles, he's supposed to light Hanukkah candles, put a mezuzah on the door, eat kosher, and so on. Okay, there's lots of commandments that the Torah has, which presumably when you observe them, or the more we observe, the more mitzvot, kindness to others, tzedakah, so many, right? 613, in fact, right? So we'd imagine that when we engage in these mitzvot, that's how we connect to God, and that's how we become holy, right? So what's this separate command of being holy? What does that mean? How do you be holy other than, how do you fulfill the commandment to be holy other than the commands that the Torah already gives? Yeah. So he answers the question by introducing the following idea. And he says, what it means is, Kadesh atzmecha b'mutarlach, which means sanctify yourself, make yourself holy in those things that are permitted to you. What does that mean? So he says there's an idea. It's a very famous expression. It's a funny expression. He says, it's possible, for the person to technically observe all the mitzvot of Torah, but he's a naval birushut ha-Torah. He's a lowlife with the Torah's permission. What does that mean? So he says, this is exactly what it means. For example, a person could eat kosher and be very meticulous in kosher, right? Let's say. It's an important thing. Don't get me wrong. I advocate for kashrut, right? Good idea. Everyone wants to kasher their kitchen. Come to me. I'll help you do it, step by step, of how you can keep kosher. Even in Sydney, by the way, it's possible. But anyway, so it is important, but it doesn't make you holy necessarily. It's important for whatever reason. Many. That's for a separate shiur why that's important, but it doesn't necessarily make you holy. Why? And we see this today more than we saw at any time in history, in a way. He says, because you can keep the mitzvah and you can be very meticulous and you still be a low life because you indulge to such an extent and you follow your pursuit of pleasure and your whole life is just, talking about food, you just always have the best of everything and always overindulging in everything and so on and so forth. So that's unholy. So therefore the commandment of the Torah is Kedoshim to you, you shall be holy, which means make yourself holy in that which is permitted to you. In other words, just because you have something that is kosher doesn't mean that you're exercising self-control. It doesn't mean you're exercising holiness. It doesn't mean you're eating with a purpose, you're eating with a focus, or you're living life with the values, right? Not necessarily. It could be yes, could be not, but not necessarily. And that's why he says that it instructs us to have this concept of limit your indulgence, limit your ta'ava, right? Your desire to be fully immersed in worldly pleasures. Food is just one example, but obviously there's other things too. Lots of other things, right? It could be money, it could be sexual morality, it could be lots of different things. That the Torah says, even when something is technically okay, but you still have to work on controlling your insatiable, sometimes, wants and desires in order to be a disciplined person. So that's what it means. Now, why is it so important? So, in some of the commentaries on this particular passage, they bring another famous idea. This is just an example, but it's an idea that really spreads to everything in life. That, we do many, many things in our lifetime, but you can only really you can't live in two worlds. You can only live in one world. What does that mean? You can do many different things, but you can only have one focus, right? And really it boils down to, is a person living for themselves, selfishly, to self-preserve, to pursue what is pleasurable and good for them? Or is it a person that wants to live for a higher purpose and pursue that which is beyond them? Right? And the two things don't go together. That's the problem. Like even there's this passage in the Talmud which says It doesn't mean it literally, but it says, for example, if one someone wants to, it's talking about people who excel in the study of Torah. Now, the study of Torah is not just an academic exercise, it's God's wisdom and divine wisdom and so on. So it says, how do you really be successful in Torah? It says that there's a Mishnah, a passage in Pirkei Avot, in Ethics of the Fathers, and it says, how do you really succeed learning Torah? You have to minimize worldly pleasures. It says, pat ba'melech tochal, you have to eat just bread and salt, drink water, sleep on the ground. Now, it doesn't mean that literally, but what it means, I'm assuming, right? In fact, I tell a funny fundraising story. There was a great rabbi in Europe. He was an unbelievable, he was an amazing person. His name was Rameir Shapiro. He died just before the war, but he built a yeshiva. Up until his time, yeshivas weren't so sophisticated. They didn't have dormitories. They didn't have good. See, the start, this is not working. We have to build proper buildings of education, tertiary education, Torah education, provide for the students properly, give them a dormitory, give them decent food, and so on. So he built in Lublin an amazing building, and it was called the Yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin. It still stands today, by the way. I think it's a medical center or something. The Nazis took it over. Sorry? It's a hotel. Is that what it is? Oh, it's a hotel. Okay. In fact, it's an interesting thing. He was the founder of a system of study called Daf Yomi. I don't know if you know what that is. Daf Yomi means to learn a page of Gemara, a page of Talmud, two pages. Daf means both sides of the page. A day, and it takes 7.5 years to complete the entire Talmud. And they have got permission. What they've done is they have traveled there when the cycle ends to celebrate a siyum, to celebrate a conclusion of the Talmud in his yeshiva in that building. But he's now not a yeshiva. Anyways, but so he was, so what did he do? It was Europe at the time. Poverty was pretty rampant. So he traveled to America to raise funds. And he had lots of stories. He was a very clever Jew. And there's lots of stories with Rameir Shapiro on his fundraising. Because then in America, some people didn't appreciate the whole thing. He walked into one wealthy guy and he asked for money. So the guy gave him a slap. He wasn't interested. He gave him a patch. This wealthy guy in America. So he turns around and he says, very calmly, he says, okay, that was for me. Now what's for the yeshiva? Those kind of things. Anyway, so one time he walked into a guy and he said what he's doing and he's providing for the boys. So the guy was a bit knowledgeable. So he challenged him and he says, I don't know what you're doing. Why are you building this fancy yeshiva? I mean, relatively fancy, right? And don't you know what it says in Pirkei Avot? He says, don't you know what it says in the Ethics of the Fathers? It says, if you want to succeed in learning Torah, you have to eat minimally, you have to sleep on the ground, just eat a little bit of bread. What's this dormitory kitchen in the yeshiva? What's this all about? So without blinking, within a split second, Rameir Shapiro turns around and says, no, you misread the whole passage. You didn't punctuate it properly. It's supposed to be written as a question. What the Pirkei Avot is saying, this is the way of the Torah. You're supposed to eat just a little bit of bread. You're supposed to sleep on the ground. No, of course not. You're supposed to have proper dinner. So that's how he answered it. However, having said that, that is not the simple reading of the passage. The simple reading of the passage is that it's a statement, not a question. But it doesn't mean a literal statement, obviously. But it is a statement with a message. And the statement with the message is, you've got to decide what kind of life you want to lead. In other words, it is a life of values, a pursuit of wisdom, of divine wisdom, or a higher way of living. Or you want to be completely immersed in worldly pleasures with an obsession or with a passion, right? So that's why the Mifchar Abdinim, the book that we're working through, starts this chapter by saying that it's necessary for everyone to engage in some form of discipline where we curb, at least, not all of us can leave all of our temptations or all of our wills and desires, but we have to know that we don't always follow what we want, right? That's the point. In other words, a life of complete pursuit of pleasure is a meaningless life. It's a mind of emptiness, and it's hard to have both. You can't live a life where your whole focus is just on joy and to love and to pursue pleasure and pursue physical comfort. And at the same time, you want to be a person who's giving and virtuous and life of values. They don't really go together, right? I mean, in today's modern world, sometimes you find in the world of celebrities that they try to make them go together. It normally doesn't work. We normally find out about the people that they're not such good people at the end of the day. Right? Just in context of recent ideas, right? Where people elevate celebrities to big status and then they end up to be terrible people, which often happens. So it doesn't really go together. That's part of the concept here. Now, this needs a bit of clarity because I want to just make 3 points. Okay. First of all, of course, there's nothing wrong with pleasure, right? We know that pleasure has a very big place in Jewish experience. There's even mitzvot. For example, there's a mitzvah on Shabbos to enjoy the food, right? You know, it's a famous Jewish joke that you don't gain weight on Shabbos. There's no calories on Shabbos, right? That's what the Yiddish Shabbos used to tell everyone. Always tell their guests. I know now, that's used to happen. If you used to come, my mother would say, no, Shabbos doesn't matter. They say a joke. It doesn't matter on Shabbos, but it matters after Shabbos. But nevertheless, having said that, right, there is the concept of onek Shabbat, that on Shabbos was there food that you enjoy, right? It's even a mitzvah. Despite secular myths, when they look at, for example, Orthodox communities, we know that in Torah, halachically, intimacy between a man and wife is supposed to be a pleasurable experience. That's what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be something which is pleasurable for both people in the relationship, right? We also have a concept that the Talmud tells us about a Nazarite. There's a concept in the Torah that a Nazarite wants to abstain, so he makes a vow not to drink wine and to grow his hair for a very long time. And at the end, there's a whole process of purification. You know, it's a period of abstinence where it's considered holy and so on. And at the end, there's a very interesting thing where the Torah instructs the Nazir, the Nazirite, to conclude the period of being a Nazirite with certain rituals, including certain sacrifices. One of those sacrifices is called a sin offering. Now, sin offering in the Torah is normally you bring for something you've done wrong. So the Torah says, I thought the Nazir was like a holy person, he's abstaining, he's disciplining. So why does he have to bring a sin offering? What avira, what transgression did the Nazir do when he went through this Nazirite period? And the answer the Talmud gives is because, yes, he's a very holy guy, he abstained, he's very disciplined, and it's very good, and maybe necessary even. But at the end of the day, there's a part of God's world that he cut out. Right? There's a God created grapes for a reason. And so now there's a part of God's world that he didn't derive benefit from. And it's God's creation. So obviously God created the world to use, right? Those things that he told us we could use at least. Right? So then the Nazir decided, well, he's not going to enjoy wine, he's not going to drink wine for a period of time, he's not going to drink grapes, he's not going to eat grapes. So that's a sin to a certain degree, because we're supposed to use God's world. We're not a religion of complete abstinence at the end of the day. However, what the concept here, the message is, yeah, that's true, but it always has to be with a focus. In other words, it's got to be first, our foundation has to be a life of values. Our objective has to be, what are we doing so we can be a refined person? What are we doing so we can be a giving person? What are we doing that we can be a person who's self-controlled and disciplined, that we don't give in to everything that we want, and we can make room for other people, we can make room for other things, we can make room for a higher being? That's our foundation. Within that context, of course, we don't have to torture ourselves. That's not what it's all about. And in fact, sometimes even a mitzvah to enjoy ourselves, right? There's nothing wrong with that. It depends what our foundation is, it depends what our starting point is. Right? I think that's the... In order to create that starting point, we need to remember that we are all born with temptations. We're all born with desires and a drive for pleasure, a drive for pursuit of pleasure. We're all born with that in different forms. So part of growing up, part of maturing, part of becoming a better human being, and it's an ongoing struggle sometimes, it's an ongoing process. Part of that is learning to limit them and learning to be able to say no to a tava, to say no to a temptation. Right? That's the concept here. Number one. Second clarification I wanted to make is just to understand the difference between a ta'ava and an addiction. Because they're different, right? When someone says, you know, I just can't stop eating chocolate, that might be an addiction, but it might not be, right? It might just be... And I say that for a reason, because for two reasons. First of all, because I've heard some people equate the word ta'ava with addiction, and it's incorrect. It's incorrect for two... And it's a problem for two reasons to do that. First of all, to have self-control in terms of what we call a ta'ava, our natural desires, our own, each one, we have our own little indulgences that we like to engage in. That doesn't need necessarily intervention, doesn't need treatment, it's not a pathology, it's just the condition of every human being. Every healthy human being has to work hard for self-control. It's not beyond us, and we have to believe that it's not beyond us. We have to believe that we can do it. It's hard work. We have to keep talking about it. We have to have discussions like this. But we have to inspire ourselves to step by step learn the art of self-control, learn the art of learning and having the ability to say no to things that we want. Just because we want them, it doesn't mean we have to have them. And certainly doesn't mean we have to have them now, right? But an addiction is something different. An addiction is something where a person gets to a point that they actually cannot live with something, without something. And it's a sickness that a discussion on a Thursday morning is not going to help, for sure. It gets to a point where you actually need intervention, right? So, it's both points. In other words, It's both understanding what an addiction is and be able to recognize what an addiction is and to know the kind of intervention and help that a person needs when they have an intervention. Because an addiction, when they have an addiction, because addiction really means, an addiction means that we're so involved in the indulgence that free choice has kind of gone out the window a bit. Not completely, there's still a choice to get help. A person always has free choice. But the choice to say no to that particular desire is really very weak, and it normally represents a lot of underlying stuff, right? There could be a lot of underlying trauma, or underlying background, like a self-esteem, a lot of things which have to be dealt with professionally and with a proper treatment. So that's why it's important to understand the difference, that a person with an addiction shouldn't think that they can just learn a bit of Jewish ethics and they'll cure the addiction, because they won't. And a person with a regular temptation needs to know that it's not an addiction. No, you have free choice and you can work on it and you can do something about it. So those two things. Now, there's a bit of gray area. It's not always so clear, right? It's not always so clear about which one is which, but it is sort of clear. It's only not clear somewhere in the middle, like, you know, when it sort of crosses over from something that's just a tava and something that's an addiction. But nevertheless, there is a bit of gray area, and for that we have to seek advice, obviously. Now, the third point I want to just clarify before we continue is, why do we have this concept? Like, why did God create us this way, right? Like, couldn't he have made it easier? Like, couldn't he have given us the desire from day one just to live a life of content, a life of values, a life of self-control, a life of discipline, right? Why is it so hard? Because it is hard. And the answer is because one of the fundamentals of Judaism is bechira, free choice. Because God didn't want us just to be perfect. He wanted us to choose the path of values. It's a big point, choose. The point of creation is for us to create that environment, not to have that environment. Because if God just wanted us to be that way, he would have created angels, only angels. I mean, he created angels, but he would have had only angels. The depth of the human being is that we have a struggle, as we've talked about many times. And we have two choices. And as God says in the Torah, I'm placing before you et ha-chayim v'et ha-mavet. I'm placing before you life and death. I mean, I'm placing before you good and bad, holy and unholy. And that's up to you to make a choice. It's not going to be an easy choice. It's a choice you could make. You have it, but it's not easy. In other words, God presented us that the path that we're not supposed to take is very attractive, in order that we should choose. And when we choose, we own it. And we own it as ours. And that we've made that change, and that's much more precious and much deeper. So yes, it's difficult, but it's deeper. That's why we have this concept. So because if it's cold here, do you want to just press the green button? I see some people getting a bit cold here. So. Sorry, I forgot to put it on. I just put it on before because I wanted it was very stuffy. So, okay. Yeah. Well, reward and punishment is a concept, but that's not why we do things, right? So we've got to, I like to talk about it more in the context of living a life of values and living a life of emptiness, and that's our choice. We don't know the secrets of reward and punishment and what that all means, but we've got to just attempt to live a life that's filled with good things and filled with valuable things. And valuable things means that we go beyond ourselves and beyond our own temptations, and we're not wrapped in ourselves, locked in ourselves. Because people who indulge, overindulge, and only follow what they want are normally people who are locked and trapped within themselves. That's the point. That's the idea. Now, how do we do this, of course? So again, like he did before, he connects it with wisdom. And he says, the value of intellect is recognizing temptation and separating. Right? Do not trust you are wise until you conquer desire. What does that mean? So again, this is what we said before when we talked about, I think, forgiveness or one of the other ones, right? Where he says that the first approach to this is not just self-discipline, but it's also wisdom, real wisdom. In other words, the only way we could do this is by starting with the head. Right? I've shared with you many times that the similar work of Chabad philosophy is a book called the Tanya, written by the first Chabad Rebbe, and that book is based on a few principles. One of the key principles it's based on is that Moach Shalit al Halev. Right? Nowadays it's a very common concept in cognitive, in CBT and other modern day therapies and so on. But this was an old Jewish idea that Moach Shalit al Alev, that the brain rules the heart, or the brain guides the heart at least, or controls the heart, right? So temptation, desire, pursuit of pleasure is an emotional, impulsive thing. And the only way to overcome that is through the idea of thinking, right? In other words, it's the power of intellect that allows us to see another side. So we always talked about the problem with this, right? The problem with this is that emotions work a lot faster than the brain does, right? When we see something, if you see, I don't know, a delicious chocolate cake or a very fascinating business deal, and you want to jump into it because there's that desire for food or desire for money or desire for anything else, that's an impulsive drive, that's an emotional drive, and that works very quickly. So the art of self-control comes from the art of pausing, right, as Stephen Covey likes to call it. The art of pausing and the art of thinking, right? But then he says, but then he makes a very important point, and he says, do not believe that you're truly wise until you can do this. Now what does he mean? Why? Lots of people are wise and haven't overcome their temptations, right? What has wisdom got to do with it? And we know, I want to just remind you of a thing we've talked about many times, that wisdom has three parts to it. Wisdom has three components. Chachma, Bina, and Da'at, right? Chachma is the concept. Da'at, Bina is the understanding of it. Now, that's two critical parts of wisdom. But of course, the most critical part is Da'at. Da'at means to internalize, to really connect with what you understand. So he's able to make that statement and says, do not trust that you're wise until you conquer your temptation, because you only can do that if you have the third component of wisdom. So many, many people understand concepts, can tell you how bad anger is, can tell you how bad overindulgence in food is, can tell you how bad, anything is, the need to gossip is, right? Even when you technically can justify the gossip, but still it's just a pleasure, right? It's a nice thing to talk about other people. All these different desires that we have, all these different ta'ava that we have, right? And we can lecture about it, but do we put it into practice? And the reason that we don't put it into practice sometimes is because we haven't thought about it enough. So the word for da'at, as I've shared with you many times in the Torah, the word for da'at has another meaning, another translation. That's how Hebrew works. I shared this with you 2 weeks ago. That has many, many different translations. And you have to connect them. So da'at obviously means knowledge, but da'at also means connection. Fascinating idea. In the Torah, the word for intimacy is da'at. Right from the beginning of Genesis, it says, "Va'adam yada et chava." The man, Adam, knew Eve. It's a euphemism for intimacy, right? So, and they bore children. So in other words, it's about connecting to something. So in wisdom, it's the same thing. When we understand a concept, when we understand the reason why to do this is not good, when we understand the reason why overindulging or overdrinking or over this is not good for us, it still remains a separate concept. It still remains a disconnected concept, which results in cognitive dissonance, right? And the only way that one of the only ways that we can entertain the concept and the thought of controlling ourselves and forsaking the ta'ava, as he calls it, and having that self-control, is to take it a step further, and not just to know the idea, but to connect to the idea. Connecting to the idea means to think about it a lot, to reflect upon it, to meditate it on, to really internalize it again and again and again until we connect with the concept, which is almost an oxymoron, because a concept by definition is something that is not me. Right, that's the power of our brain. We've talked about this many times, that the power of our brain is its weakness. The power of thinking is its weakness itself. The power of thinking is that we're able to entertain another side that's not me. It's not subjective, it's objective. The problem with that is that it's objective, but it's not me. So I don't have to listen to it, right? That's the problem. That's how this whole thing comes about. So my emotions, my impulses are me. That's why I adhere to them. That's why I respond to them, right? The power of intellect is saying, well, maybe that's what I want, but maybe it's not good for me. So I can entertain another concept, another idea, but the weakness of that is that it's another idea. And that's why it is another idea, which I have to have the chokhmah and the binah, but then I have to really connect with it until it becomes me. And that's how we go. That's why he says, don't call yourself a really wise person unless you can exercise self-control. And that's an amazing statement, because what's the connection between wisdom and self-control? Right? I think they tell a story about Aristotle or something, that his students once found him, he was a great intellect, a great philosopher, that his students one time found him somewhere doing something that was really not nice. And they said to him, how does that fit? Aristotle? You're the guy who lectures and ethics. And he says, that's Aristotle's in the classroom. Now I'm a different person. Right? Okay, so that's not a true wise. That's good, but it's not truly wise, right? A truly wise person, as he puts it, is being able to take the wisdom and internalize it and connect to it through the process of da'at, and then you're able to put it into practice. And I want to just share with you an interesting idea, because he says in the next quote, he says that it's the whole thing, it becomes like a mindset also, right? Eventually it becomes a mindset. In other words, like this, what I want to say is like this, that forsaking and curbing our desires is not something we do all the time, right? Most people are not self-controlled all the time. But what we can do is, we can try create a little bit of a foundation, a mindset. What type of person am I? And I'm going to show you an interesting idea, because he says here that wisdom guides and instructs adherents while the slave of passions led astray in pressures. Right? In other words, if we're a person that just follows everything we want, we're a very trapped individual. So I'll try to share with you, to explain this, a very interesting sentence in the Shema. You know, the Talmud says that how does desires come about? Any type of desire. So it says in the Talmud that Ha'ayin Ro'eh, the eye sees and the heart desires, right? That works. To use a very basic and simple analogy, right? You could be, you're not in the mood of eating altogether, but suddenly you see something delicious that you know is really bad for you, but suddenly you want it. Why do you want it? Because you saw it, right? Right? You saw a delicious cake, right? It's not like you're walking around a whole morning craving for cake. And suddenly you see it, now you can't control yourself. Why? That's what the Talmud says. Ha'ayin ro'eh, the eye sees, and I left chomed, and the heart desires. And it's true in many, many areas of temptation in life. And yet, that's the order, right? And yet, when we say the Shema, in the third paragraph of Shema, there's a sentence where God tells us not to follow our eyes and our heart for everything we want, but it switches the order. It says, V'lo taturu, do not follow, acharei levavchem, after your heart, v'acharei einechem, and after your eyes. Right? Like, exercise self-control. Don't follow everything your heart wants and your eye sees. Right? So commentaries ask the question, it's the wrong order. If the Talmud says correctly that the way it normally works is the eye sees and the heart desires, so in the Torah, the Pasuk, the verse should have said the other way around. It should have said, don't follow your eyes and your heart. Correct? Yeah, question clear? So, one of the answers that's given for this is the following. Yeah, in practice, that's the way it works, right? That your eyes see something, then you want it. But when it comes to giving in to every temptation, there's a fundamental problem. In other words, the person who every time they see something wants it and can't discipline themselves and can't stop, that's the person that their whole heart is in the wrong place. In other words, they've got what's called in Kabbalistic language, p'tichat alev. In other words, the heart just opened to everything. In other words, they're just a frivolous person. They're just someone that just that's the way they live. Right? In other words, yes, practically it works. You see and then you want. But there's a foundation that works in the background. And that's what the Torah is talking about. Who are you? Are you a free person, truly free? Free, not in the sense you do whatever you want, but free of yourself? Or are you a slave to your temptation? A slave to my temptation means that whatever, I'm just a person full of desire. I don't think, I don't discipline, I don't hold back, I just do whatever I want. That's a slave. That's what he's saying over here. That's a concept that just a person that can never escape that. Whereas a person who is a disciplined person, meaning the person has a mindset that's different. The mindset is, no, I need to live a life of higher values. I need to be a person that doesn't give in to everything I want. Then it might still be that sometimes I do, but at least I've got that foundation that allows me to have that process of self-control. And that's why the Torah says, first of all, Tzur Acharei Levavchem. First of all, don't follow your heart. That's number one. Create a foundation that not everything you want, you need. Right? We often talk like this about children. That's where it starts, right? That's how I always say it is very important for children to develop the ability of self-control, but those children never developed it for whatever reason. They can still do it, because the human being's condition is that unless it falls into the category of a real addiction, we can control ourselves. And we can even learn self-control later on in life, right? Now, it's a little unfair. Some people are born with no one's born with perfect self-control, and no one's born without the ability of self-control. But some people are born with a bit of a head start, that's true. They have other challenges, because every human being has challenges. But some people are born with a little bit of a disposition towards greater self-control, and that's certainly a head start. But most people aren't, and I'm saying that because of that famous marshmallow experiment, right, which I've shared with you many times. So, yeah. It's obvious that some kids have it more naturally. But the point of the study is not that just to tell the story of human history, but the point is to do something about it. In other words, that not all kids have it naturally, and therefore we need to teach them. But we have to teach ourselves as adults as well. And that's what the Torah says. First of all, don't follow your heart as a foundation. And be a person that's prepared to say, not everything I want, not everything my heart desires, do I have to give in to. I need to live a life of self-control so that I can live a higher life. By the way, the self-control itself is not it's a means to an end. It's not the end itself. Self-control is to create space. It's to free myself from myself that I can connect to something higher. And it's definitely hard work, right? As we know, it's hard work. But that's the key to success, right? What do they say in the dictionary? I've said this with you before. The only place... the only place success comes before work is in the dictionary. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's how it goes. What's that? True success, in other words, success of meaningful success, is something always that comes with work. Why? Because what have I said before? God created us the way He created us to have that struggle, so that we should choose, that we should own it, and we should be people that have worked for ourselves, and reach that concept. Now, when I say it's hard work, there are a number of components of this hard work, right? This idea of self-control is a hard process. First of all, it's just hard, right? It's hard to hold back. It's very hard to pause. Second of all, when we pause, what are we going to fill that pause with? We have to engage in study. We have to engage in our thinking. We have to engage in internalizing and bringing out that wisdom we spoke about before, that idea of that. We have to be able to really do that, right? Also, we have to do is we have to be honest. One of the things, I didn't put it on the board, but one of the things that he talks about in the chapter is that ta'ava is ivaron, that ta'ava, desire, blinds a person. Very often we want something and we know maybe we shouldn't do it, but then we say, no, it's very good for us, and we post-rationalize in a very distorted way. And that's a problem. Once we get into distorted thinking, we're really stuck, because it's our thinking that can save us from overindulgence in temptation. That's when we start to be dishonest with ourselves that we lost, because then our thinking is not working properly. So the idea of being objective and being honest and getting advice from others is so important, but we're not sure whether we should or we shouldn't, right? Now, it is definitely harder today. It's harder today because there's so much abundance today, right? The idea of... I was thinking of an interesting story that my grandfather told me. So my grandfather, which I've mentioned many times, he was... when I knew him, he was obviously older as my grandfather, and he was an excellent, a very, very excellent Baal Koreh, in other words, the Torah reader. He would, every Shabbat, he'd read the Torah, and he'd done it all his life to the point he knew it by heart. He didn't do it by heart, because you're not allowed to, you have to actually read it. But he didn't have to prepare. He didn't have to prepare anymore. Like, he knew. In fact, one time we had a minyan at our home for some reason, and he was really not well. He couldn't even see very well. It was towards the end of his life. And my father was reading the Torah, and he made a mistake. And my grandfather, who was not looking in a chumash, and he was looked like he was half asleep, corrected him. So no, it's not the way it's written. Okay, right. So I once asked him. I said, "How did you do this?" So he said, "You got to do it when you're young." And he told me a story. So he was a little town, and was born. It was white Russia called Dokshitsi, and poverty was incredibly strong then. People didn't have they didn't have food. They didn't have like it was you know. And in fact, his mother passed away when he was young. His mother passed away from starvation. It was like that. So it was an unbelievable time. And he said when he was just about a year or two after his bar mitzvah, he wanted to learn to read the Torah, learn to lane. And he learned, and he wanted to do it. And there was a shul that needed a Torah reader. So the rabbi of the shul told him, if you prepare it during the week, prepare it really well, come to me early Shabbat morning. I'll test you. You'll read it for me from a Mizrah. And if you're really good, then you could read it in shul. And if you're really good, I'll give you a glass of milk and a piece of a bulka, which means like a Danish, right? A piece of cake. Yeah. Can you imagine that? What a prize, right? That didn't get paid for reading the Torah, nothing. Just what did he get? A glass of milk and a piece of cake. And that was worth it for him a whole week to work really hard, because he knew he would get that on Shabbat morning, right? And it's an amazing thing, because, you know, he was a person, I remember growing up, I used to wonder, like, I thought it was like this old people thing maybe, but like he liked good food and he would eat properly and he would take care of himself, but he was an amazing disciplined person. Like, just when it comes to food, for example, he never ate between meals. Like, only once he'd had a cup of tea and that, but he was would eat well, but, and I realize now, because it came from not being spoiled, basically, right? We live in a very spoiled generation. There's such abundance. And when there's abundance, everything's in front of you, self-control becomes much, much harder. But something that is so important we have to work towards. I want to show you a story. It's the same guy that I showed you a couple of weeks ago. But it's an amazing story. I've forgotten what his name is. We'll see it in the video. But it's a story of a person who didn't give in to money temptation for a higher purpose. And this goes what I started off with. That the whole point of this idea is that we need to try and live a life of meaning. And living a life of meaning means that sometimes we can't have it all. Sometimes we have to give up in order to live a life of purpose. So listen to the story.
Business decision for 70-year-old dad. is to take the $300 million, the insurance, and retire.
And what would I do with it? Eat more? Buy another suit? Retire and die? No, that did not go into my mind. That was not an option. Not for a second. I was only 14 years old when this happened. But recently, when I heard about it again, I wondered, is Mr. Feuerstein still alive? Can I interview him? Can I meet him? And maybe even can I get a blessing from a great man like that? I made some calls, and I found that he lives in Brooklyn, Massachusetts. He's alive and well. He hasn't given an interview in 25 years. He said yes. I took along my 12-year-old son, Charlotte. We traveled to Boston. We came to the house of his granddaughter, Marika Feuerstein. He lives with his granddaughter, 95. Not a young man anymore, but completely healthy and completely with it. As I walked into his home and shook his hand, I could see in his eyes the wisdom, the life experience. And I was really excited to sit and talk with him. The first question I asked him, I said, Mr. Feuerstein, what gave you the courage, the strength to walk away from hundreds of millions of dollars and do what's right and treat the workers properly like human beings, take care of them?
First of all, the Torah. As a young man, when I read and studied the Torah, that showed me the way of life. That was very, very important. Lo sa'ashok safed, not to oppress the worker. You have a lot of workers, not to oppress the worker. Because he's a Rani and a nephew, we considered him a human being, not a pair of hands. And there's a difference.
So my father was a great example, he was a big tzaddik. He also taught me to be a mensch.
My father was a tzaddik and had great influence over me. Today we see Orthodoxy prospering. But when my father was a young man, Orthodoxy was dying. And my father was the one who kept the Orthodox alive in Boston. The business was started by his father, Henry Feuerstein. He came over to this country in his teens, and he read in the Forbes Yiddish newspaper that there was a factory for sale in Malden. He went to see the factory. He knew nothing about knitting machinery, nothing about sweaters, nothing about anything, any product. He said, there's a place where I can go to shul, I'll be my own boss, and he bought it. And the business prospered. And by the time I got to the business, the Malt Knitting Mills was ranked AAA1 for credit, and they were worth millions.
I asked him about the employees when they returned to work in Malden Mills after it was rebuilt. They increased productivity by 40% without a wage increase, just as an expression of gratitude to Mr. Feuerstein and what he had done.
We had good employees. Many of them couldn't even speak English, but were treated like human beings. They were just terrific. They wanted me to succeed, and they increased employment without a wage increase.
Then I asked him a very difficult question. I said, Mr. Feuerstein, I know that eventually your company went bankrupt. Do you ever feel that had you not done that good deed and spent the tens of millions of dollars on the employees, paying them while the company was being rebuilt, do you ever feel like you would have had the money to continue going?
No. You have no right to defame God's name with your business or with your family, whatever your enterprise is. I was too enthusiastic. I should have gone slow. I wanted to go rapidly. And so I paid for it.
Something I was really proud of was the building of the Shul in Israel.
Okay. That was, wow. There's fun stuff. So, sorry?
His first name?
I don't know what his first name is. Feuerstein. I didn't catch his first name. But it's quite an amazing thing. I think this is the concept I'm trying to bring out. It doesn't always go together. We sometimes have to give up to live a life of values. So just in conclusion, so it's just the final quote in this chapter is this, I think, sums it up. said, the sage will ask, which is the most commendable war? So he answered, that is war which is waged against our evil desires, was the reply. In other words, this war, this struggle, but overcoming temptation is the most worthwhile war to actually fight. All right, now of course there is a good side of the concept of Tava. We're not having enough time to go into it now. We mentioned before from the Maharal of Prague, who says that the concept of desire has to be channeled, because at the end of the day we don't get out of bed unless we have desires. So it's about channeling our desires towards good things, to have that drive, that passion, that force to want things, but obviously to want good things and to want valuable things, and that's the channeling of this concept. So that brings us towards the end of the series and towards the end of the year. I just wanted to mention again a few things. I'll just go back at the draft so we can just show you again those two shiurim that we're going to have. The one on the 19th of December at 10 a.m. That's the Hanukkah discussion, and also another Hanukkah discussion Wednesday, 21st of December. Next year, and the summer learning program on the 26th of December. Next year, we're going to start the new series, new term on Thursday. The Thursday session will start a little bit earlier, but the Thursday session will start 2nd of February. That's Thursday, 2nd of February. That's the first week of the term. It's been an interesting year. This is the year we came back from all the COVID stuff. We're getting together. Hopefully next year will be even more and better. We'll get back to where we were before. Thank you all for participating and wishing everyone a Chanukah Sameach, a good and safe and healthy summer. And hopefully we'll see you at some of the stuff over the next few weeks. And enjoy.
Thank you.